If you just deal with the secular humanist aspects of information and life, you're doomed.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about just doomed and you're not going to be successful and have a business and make some money. I'm talking about finding the things like happiness, yeah. like a contentment, joy.
Welcome to the WFO Life Podcast. Buckle up for interviews, insights, and practical discussions, and the occasional intellectual oddity, all designed to help you master self, master craft, and accomplish any life mission.
Hello, folks, and welcome back to the WFO Life Podcast. Today, we have another special interview. In the recent weeks, we've been doing interviews with coaches, various backgrounds. Today, we're going to break from that theme. And we are going to have on a true radio professional. So this is going to be, he's slumming here today on our podcast with this audio quality we've been playing with here. So we're very excited for our guest. Before we get to our guest, I'd like to say hi to Chris. How's it going today?
Doing good. I'm glad we're on Zoom so you South Texans can see how we live up here in the Northeast with all this foot of snow and dead trees behind me. So
yeah,
it's all white cool. Behind you. I thought you had a white screen.
Yeah, that's right.
I know, right? The white screen of death. So.
Well, today our guest is a good friend of mine, and I struggled with how to enter, you know, kind of start the interview with you because of so many things you've done. So I thought we'll just jump right in, but today I have a good friend, Bob Jones, with me. Bob is kind of a renaissance man as far as I'm concerned, father, a husband, a minister. He's been a veteran, public servant, maybe politician at times, and he's definitely a radio talk show legend, in my opinion. And today we'd like to welcome Bob Jones.
Well, thank you. The only thing you forgot is small businessman. Which was one of the most interesting parts of my life.
Well, we're going to get to that then. Well, thank you for coming on. Have you done a podcast before?
Well, no. On the radio, they wanted me, in addition to my show, 4 hours a day, 5 days a week, to maybe do a podcast from time to time. Mm-hmm. I'm saying, make whatever I say on the show the podcast.
That's right.
Because it's a whole nother genre. It's right. A whole nother discipline.
Right.
And the first podcasts were on video. Mm-hmm. And people had visuals behind them, around them. But to do a podcast with nothing but dot content, you got to be compelling. You got to be interesting. You got to know the attention span and right. All that. And I'm saying, I don't want to work on another job. It is a different genre.
It is. And, you know, we've talked a little bit off air. You know, I've done live radio with you before, which is mm-hmm. it's a whole dance in itself, really. And we're going to get into that for sure. But for folks that don't know you, Bob, take us back. You know, everybody, Superman, Batman, everybody has an origin story. So tell us about your
far, far away.
That's right. Tell us your origin story.
Well, if you ask me what I was, my wife and my daughters and them were joking the other day because my granddaughter, San Antonio, was in a school with her dad up in Del Rio. Mm-hmm. And she said, "Is Poppy a Mexican?" They call me Poppy.
Mm-hmm.
Said, "Is Poppy a Mexican?" I said, "Well, why'd you ask that?" She said, "Because there was a lot of Mexican cowboys." and they know that I dress Western.
Right, right.
I did it even back east. I used to go up to the Pocono Mountains to ride, and mm-hmm. I always had the hats and stuff. Back when I was a little boy, I used to get. If I wanted something for Christmas or was going to get something for Christmas, I would get vests and chaps and hat, you know.
Yeah.
And in fact, I was so tiny, I had to take, when I did get them to buy me two gun holster,
mm-hmm.
I had to take the buckle and tie it in a knot to keep it
yeah.
on my waist.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how little I was.
Yeah.
But they said, really, he's mixed-ish, yes, which is a new TV show. You got black-ish.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you got the mixed-ish. Well, my father's father was slave, descended from slaves that landed in New Bern, North Carolina.
Okay.
His father was born into slavery, but his mother was the slave and his father was one of the white men. So he came out really light-skinned, having been born to a slave mother. So you know where that story is.
Right, right.
On my mother's side, they're from New England, New Bedford, Massachusetts. My mother's father, Louis Vargas, was born in Saint-Nazaire, France. His father was French, and his mother was from Martinique, which was a French colony at the time, which is now a province. So I've got a white Frenchman, a white plantation owner, somebody, if not the overseer. My mother's mother was Portuguese, who married a Dutchman. And from the Dutch side, I can trace back to the Mayflower.
Wow.
So I got Portuguese, I got Dutch, I got French, I got white American, since everybody likes to single that as a category.
Right.
I got Portuguese, and you know, I have African from descended exactly from African North Carolina. So when they asked me, they said, "Are you black?" I always say, "No, I'm mocha."
Yeah, mix-ish.
And mocha, because I think it's ridiculous. I think the most racist, and I don't want to go off on a tangent. You want to ask me about color?
No, no. It's your origin.
One of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard in my life is calling anybody that has any kind of touch of color or melt in their skin, calling them black.
Right.
I mean, how racist can you be? Obama's mother was white. He was carried in her womb for 9 months, a white woman, but yet he's black.
Right.
If his daddy was white and his mother was black, he'd still be black.
Right.
Tiger Woods' mother is from, what, is it Thailand?
Yeah, I think Thai, yes.
Yeah, a Thai, and his daddy is mixed.
Right.
Because he's light-skinned, so you gotta be mixed, but yet he's black. That's the racist thing.
Right.
You know, that I've spent my life. But when I was coming up, we moved into a Jewish neighborhood before the white flight. We were the first black.
And where was this?
Philadelphia.
Philadelphia. Okay.
My dad was hardworking. He had he was a prize fighter, professional fighter. I got a scrapbook. I'll let you see.
Yeah, I'd like to see that.
He won 54 in a row as a welterweight before he lost his first decision. His manager hired him out as a opponent to, what do you call it, training partner?
Yeah, like a sparring partner.
Yeah, a sparring partner to a guy who was training for a fight with the champ, Armstrong. And they saw him, and he never got a title fight because they knew how
good he was. Yeah, that was not somebody you wanted to tank
with. Yeah, and plus the mob had a lot of hands in that and whatnot. Yeah. But he was a personal fighter. He took his winnings, and he bought a restaurant up in New Bedford, Massachusetts.
Okay.
And in his restaurant, my mom walked in. She was in high school at the time, and that's how he met her.
Nice.
But we lived in Philadelphia, and we moved into this Jewish neighborhood. And on a Jewish holiday, the only kids in school was maybe three or four Gentile kids, and me, my brother, and my sister.
Mm-hmm.
She was in kindergarten. I think I was in second grade. My brother was in fourth grade. So, and then we saw the neighborhood change. But I grew up pretty much Jewish. I used to, you know, say my grace, Baruch Ator, Alnor, Alohenu, Melech Halag. Yeah, I mean, Humantash, the prune Humantash, and the matzo ball soup. And the, I still today like my my lox, and I'd rather have Nova lox. Nova Scotia lox is not as salty as other lox. Thinly shaved on a bagel with capers, onions.
Very specific.
It's very Philly. That's very Northeast in Philly. I was going to say.
Big Jewish community.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I was going to say my kids to this day, since we live in the suburbs, like I told you before we started recording, we get all the Jewish holidays off. And so that's the cool thing about military kids is, you know, it's a pain in the butt to move every few years. But you talk about, you know, getting exposed to diversity and different types of people, different socioeconomic backgrounds. I think that's been one of the coolest things to see as my kids grow up. There's a big Russian population up here too. So between the Jewish holidays that they had to learn about and then being around the Russian population, it's been cool being up here in the Northeast City. But what I wanted to ask you, Bob, is, so did you grow up Jewish because, you know, your family was like had became?
Well, I can say that, but no, it was a Jewish neighborhood.
So that's what I thought. Yeah.
I mean, so if I went to be in the Boy Scouts, it was at the synagogue. I had to go to the synagogue to be in the Boy Scouts.
Yeah, it's just the culture you grew.
They used to go on nature trips and things like that. But back then in Philadelphia, you can go out to Fairmount Park and go to the stream, and it was live salamanders in the stream, and and it was crayfish in the little. I mean, there was things was alive. All that stuff is dead now. There's nothing out there. But later on, skip fast forward, the neighborhood switched and changed. But I went to a high school, Dobbins. Merrill Dobbins, you had to take an IQ test to get in. And I don't know how I got in because I just volunteered to go so I could get out of school one day. you know what's funny? Later on, I was told by the principal, who was a teacher at the time, that I had the highest IQ of anybody in my freshman class and graduating class. And he said, but having said that, he said, you are the greatest underachiever in the history of the school.
It's like a backhanded comment there.
Yeah, yeah, that's like the definition of a backhanded compliment.
Yeah, yeah. That's funny.
Yeah, I stayed in the hall so much that they made me the school photographer. And my yearbook was full of impromptu photos and stuff that really made that yearbook sing.
That's cool. So you were doing creative stuff back then.
Yeah, very good, way back then. But in my school, since you have to take an IQ test, and there were three like that in school. It was Italian, German, and Irish, and Lithuanian, and there was all kind of kids. You know, blacks was a small part of it, but I was raised in my high school. We had to get along with kids from all ethnicities because Philadelphia is divided into neighborhoods.
Yeah, for
sure. The Italian neighborhood in South Philly, there's a Polish neighborhood, Lower Allegheny, and another one up near Manayunk. It's a Polish neighborhood. In fact, I'm an official member of the Adam Kowalski Polish War Veterans Post. So, and then the Irish Society, you know, the Irish, you know, in their section, and the Jewish people moved up to the Northeast. And then you had, so when I became president, the first minority to become president of Philadelphia County Young Democrats, and it was a Democrat city, I would travel to all those ethnicity, all those neighborhoods. And I was comfortable because I'd come up in a high school that had all kind of cultures and all kind of backgrounds. You know, having started out as a kid, eating liver canishes and all that, Larry's father's, he had a shoe shop. Lillian, who's in my class, her father had a girl's dress store. Gonzalowitz had the pharmacy. My brother worked at the pharmacy. This thing about diversity and isolating and separating for me, not only is foreign, but it's demonic. Because America, when I came up, was out of many, we become one. One in idea, one in goal, one in opportunity. I mean, that's what it was. And somebody reversed all of that by focusing on diversity. And I heard you mention that about Philadelphia. Considering a Jewish neighborhood, then a mixed high school. I mean, it was to call the roll. I can still remember in my head, Vic Bach Brongo, you know, starting with the B's and the C's. Right. From there, when I went into the military, you know, I'm mixing because when I went into the military, man, it was people from everywhere. My love is
like I was going to say, Bob, you know, I'm glad you're talking about this because the military, I think, I know from history was one of the kind of first, I guess you'd say forced integration, you know, based on a common goal, right? Because you need people from all different walks of life to accomplish the mission. And so I think the military for a lot of people that grew up in their own little pocket and never saw anybody that didn't look like themselves. I know the military is kind of one of the best experiments, I think, in people from different backgrounds accomplishing a mission, right?
Now, there were people with biases. There were people that were mean and nasty. Even if I was going to use the word racist, they were in the military. But by and large, it's just a coming together of everybody. I mean, you got about 20 guys, you know, in a platoon, in a barracks, and they're from all kind of places. But what the military forces to do was work together in spite of the differences.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so when I went to Vietnam, and I'm going to jump ahead again, but when I went to Vietnam, there were some of us there that didn't like each other. There were some of there that had never experienced people that were different. And I'm not just that there were some people that were white from the South who had never been around those slick guys from New York City, you know, and then there were people that that would be from the what are those the guys out in the country where you get the raw milk?
Yeah, Amish.
Amish.
We had Amish guys in there, and that was a whole nother thing to some of the rest of us. And we had Black guys from the inner city, and we had some that had gone to college but didn't finish because. But the point was, when we got to Nam, we needed each other. We found out that each other did their jobs extremely well. So we definitely had to depend. But then again, we started liking each other because we got past all the other stuff. And then even though we argued and fought, just like brothers, you better not fight them. I can fight my brother, but you better not touch my brother, you know?
Yeah.
But it was for me, all these experiences, you know, why I vary. And then through the military, I went to different countries. Two in particular was Vietnam. Need to say I'd never been to Southeast Asia. and then when I came back to Texas, I re-enlisted and I picked my duty station because they finally let me work my MOS, which was a comm center specialist. I had a top secret cosmic crypto and I used to decipher from behind the iron curtain. So when I came back from Vietnam, which they made me an advisor to South Vietnamese soldiers, 2006 Vietnamese Regiment, 2nd Army, and I couldn't speak Vietnamese, but they told me, I said, but I'm supposed to be in a communication center protected. They say, you an infantryman first.
Yeah, that's what we trained.
Yeah, so, but eventually I went to work for NATO in Europe, Southeastern European Task Force. The point is, later on, I also became a missionary. And I've gone on mission trips to Africa. I've gone on mission trips to Martinique in the Caribbean. I've gone on mission trips in Europe, like countries like France. I've gone on mission trips to Islamic Republic of Pakistan. And the funny part is all of that coming together, I now pastor a church that's got a Russian, it's got a Haitian, it's got a German, it's got whites or what they call Anglos, it's black. It's a multi, but isn't that what the world is supposed to be?
I was going to say, Bob, you know, when I most of the countries I've been to, obviously with what's been going on during my career, been in the Middle East and Korea also. But, you know, one of the things that I think the military got, I mean, they probably learned, you know, a lot from, you know, the Vietnam and other experiences, but they got better at, you know, they're not going to teach you everything about every culture, but you know, there's certain things that are universal and there's certain, you know, I know people make a big deal about, oh, don't do this, don't do that in these countries. But really, I think, you know, you mentioned being a missionary. I think sometimes being in the military, if we do it right, we should feel like missionaries of sorts, you know, but more so about missionaries of, you know, what freedom and, you know, democracy and, you know, republic is supposed to look like. And so I think that that's the cool thing when, you know, I was in Iraq and other countries in the Middle East is, you know, the example of how we conducted ourselves, even in, you know, odd circumstances, I think was being a missionary of sorts on like, hey, you know, you may have heard a lot of things about America growing up and, you know, hopefully we can, you know, change your mentality about who we are because we're just people like you. We just happen to be born somewhere else.
Well, but I'm amazed that it took so long. The secret to winning Ramadi was number two, to go in, be with the people, among the people, and stay with the people. I mean, we used to go through a ville and Papa San and them would come out and they, and, you know, and agree to work with us. We would leave. The VC would come in at night, kill people, threaten them. I mean, because we in Vietnam, we held no ground. You know that, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, so they go.
The Marines, yeah, you're talking about too. I know the Marine Corps did a lot of the combined action patrols, like the CAPS, where they would, you know, have Vietnamese and Americans living together and patrolling together. And like you're saying, I mean, you have to live amongst the people and, you know, build trust. You can't just come in when it's convenient and leave and expect them to help you out.
And one of the things that helped me, as I said, my youth growing up when I was in elementary school, you know, I remember reading the papers about Eisenhower as a kid. So that gives you an idea how old I am. And I remember two things about Eisenhower. Three things. He was the president of the United States. He played golf a lot and he had heart attacks a lot. I mean, I think yeah. I remember
yeah.
About Eisenhower, but I was in elementary school in the 50s. I knew real racist. Look, one day, you heard of the Mama's Parade?
Yes.
Philadelphia Mama's Parade?
Yes, of course.
It's a tradition. It's from a Black culture item, but it had been racist, you know, only limited to whites, and they were drunk and marching and praying, but we all went to it. It didn't matter. It was South Philadelphia kind of tradition.
True.
And we went with a bunch of kids from our church, and I was little and I got lost.
Hmm.
Oh, geez.
I got lost. You know how many people show up at the Mama's Parade on Broad Street? Yeah. You know, it's insane. And I got lost, and it was winter and it was cold, but I had enough wherewithal to go to City Hall. And right in the middle of City Hall then, there was a police substation. So I saw the sign that said police, because I didn't want to leave City Hall. I didn't know, go this street, Market Street. You know. So I went and I told, and the guy was sitting behind the desk, like you, don't turn into him now. and big ruddy faced guy. And he said, yes, and I said, I'm lost in the law. And he said, well, where do you live? And I told him, I was living, it was called Strawberry Mansion then. And I told him where I lived. And he told me, well, you know, this is how you get there and this is so. So I was scared because I mean, I was a long way from home. Mm-hmm. And I said, can somebody take me there? And he looked at me, said, take you there? And what else do you want? A gold-plated pillow for your little black A?
Oh.
That's what he said. He cursed and he said it. So I said, no. And I looked at the map. And I went out and I started walking down Broad Street. He said, go to see Montgomery Avenue and then make a left. Broad Street, you know, I mean, North Philly, that's like going to Temple campus, walking from downtown Philadelphia to the university. And I'm fortunately it was New Year's Day and wasn't a lot of traffic, wasn't a lot of people.
Right.
And I'm looking at every sign, every street, and I'm walking. And then I look up and I see Montgomery Avenue. And I go, this is it. So I turn and I start walking. Now I'm not walking on Broad Street, which is like 8-lane, you know, businesses. And
Right. Now
I'm in the neighborhood. I'm going through neighborhoods, always, you know, ethnic neighborhoods. You know, the Irish can't walk into the Italian neighborhood.
Right.
You know, and they better not venture over to the Polish neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And I'm walking up these streets. Now I had to go to 32nd Street. Broad Street is 14th Street. Give you an idea. And I'm a little kid. And I'm walking and I'm walking and I'm looking and I'm walking. And then I see this little bridge, you know, where the train goes. And I know that's like 20, 30th Street. And I go over the bridge. I'm at 31st Street and I'm close and I start running. And I go home and I knock. This is hours now. Me, little kid. I think I might have been around 9 or something, maybe 8. And I got there. And they said, here he is. He said, I said, well, I wasn't angry. I never hated that guy. Mm-hmm. You know what I said? I said, I did it.
Yeah.
I did it.
Yeah.
I came downtown and walked home by myself. I did it. And from that point on, I would walk over 33rd down to Benjamin Franklin Parkway, go down to Old City, you know, and down there with, you know, with Old City, Betsy Ross house. And this, I just traveled all over the city.
By yourself?
By myself. Cause I did it.
Yeah. Is it the confidence to do it?
Well, I'll say that there's a lot of good lessons in there, Bob. You know, like, I think sometimes nowadays we're not that you'd want to have your kid do that, but you know, sometimes if you have those experiences that gives you, you know, like you said, it gives you confidence to say, hey, I did it once. I can do it again and do it by design this time. You know, and so I think, you know, whether it's playing sports or, you know, getting kids involved in different things, you know, you got to let them fail a little bit. You got to let them
have
a little scar tissue, you know, not keep them in like a, you know, pillowed room their whole
life. I was not a snowflake. Trust me. And we had to do that. And again, so I was down at 6th Street. I walked from 32nd Street all the way downtown to 6th Street. And I'm looking in this old antique shop and the little, little Jewish guy, he came by and he saw me looking in there. And he said, come on in, take a look. And I looked around and I saw, you know, the old furs with the heads and the claws to them. And I saw these embroidered dresses. And I mean, my, It was just the world was opening up.
Yeah, it's an education.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I was gonna say, Bob, you mentioned earlier that you were like the president of the Young Democrats. So was it so obviously at a young age you got involved a little bit in the political arena. What caused you to do that? Was it anything specific?
I had an experience, and I'm trying to keep you, because I got out of high school in 76. I mean, my graduating class was 65, 1965. Mm-hmm. I got out of the military. I was in Vietnam, 67, 68. I turned 20 on the 25th of January in country, in my outpost out in Tam Kee. We had a advisory team that had Marines. We had some Navy, for corpsmen. We had some forward air controls from the Air Force. We had some Army, just a little team. Yeah. And I turned 20. I was 19 when they sent me there in April of 67.
Wait, when you said they sent you there, were you drafted or?
No, I wasn't drafted. I was told by somebody who worked for the draft board that my number was coming up.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. But I was told if you come up, you do 2 years and they send you where they want you to go. But if you volunteer, it's only 3 years. In fact, wasn't the Marines 4 years? I know the Air Force was 4 years and the Marines was two. But I know what they were going to do when you were a Marine. Mm-hmm. Marine in basic and Paris Island, man, that stuff was legendary. You got to be, which is why I respect the Hispanic community. I know this is an aside.
Right.
Look, I went into the Army. I was trying to be something other than an infantry, wound up out there with the infantry. But later on, I didn't. But the Hispanics, they're patriotic, man. Mm-hmm. With this great move that you saw in this last election, mm-hmm. they're realizing that we're conservative. We believe in God. Mm-hmm. Even the gang lords have Mary and cathedrals and crosses tattooed. Mm-hmm. They believe in family. I sold long-term care insurance in South Texas for years and never sold a policy to a Black or a Hispanic. Usually their family takes care of their own.
Right, right.
You move the family and ain't nobody coming in here. Clean it, we'll clean and we'll take care. Right. And they're not going into a facility. But they believe in family. They believe in God. They believe in home. Most of them will go to work, try to buy a little house, marry their childhood sweetheart, maybe of my generation, and they'll volunteer to go into the military. And most often, the Marines.
Yep.
Now,
You can call it macho, you can call it whatever you want, some brave rascals who love their country and willing to put their life online for it. So anybody that would try to divide us over some racial stuff, they don't get it. They don't get it at all. But
So you enlisted and then
I enlisted.
And you, how long were you?
I enlisted because I was tired of my father telling me what to do. In my house, you're going to do this. In my house, you're going to be in it such and such a time.
And how old were you?
Well, I was a teenager.
Okay.
I was a teenager.
At least, what, 18 then?
17, 18. It started probably earlier than that.
Yeah.
I mean, because if you didn't eat when the family was eating, you wasn't there. The food was put away.
Mm-hmm.
If you weren't in at a certain time, the door was locked. Mm-hmm. The door to the house. This is my house.
Military in Vietnam starts looking like a good option.
Well, I didn't think Vietnam, although some people in my high school had gone and some had actually been killed. I'm thinking the military. Go ahead, be the man, see the world. That's mm-hmm. the part I saw. Join an army, see the world.
Yeah.
I didn't know. I didn't want my father to tell me what to do. I had no idea that there was a guy that lived in the military and his name was Sarge. I mean, this guy, man, he's hollering and screaming and push you around. I mean, his was a guy.
all of us weird lifers, right?
Look, somebody said, bleep the army. So I've heard it.
Oh, boy.
He turned around. He pushed his hat up. He said, boy, I don't talk about your home. You don't talk about my home, filth, foul. I'm going to go, oh, my God. Who would ever thought of the military as their home?
Mm-hmm.
The lifers, like you just said.
Yeah. I mean, I'm hitting year 20 right now. So us sickos that keep saying, I'll do I'll do two or three more. Yeah, I'll do two or three.
But we need you. We need you because they need experience. They need guidance. You know, they need this to let people know that is a good career choice for a lot of people.
It is. Yeah.
Is it a career choice? So, but you were asking me before I went off on a tangent about the going into the military.
Yeah. So you went at your MOS, you wanted some type of communication MOS. Is that right? And then you ended up in the bush, though.
Yes. In fact, I went to training in Fort Gordon, Georgia, and learned how to run the crypto machines and all, you know, to send code and, and get in code. And then, what was that thing called? It had the wheel and we learned how to do all of that stuff. Then they sent me from there. I took a train from Fort Gordon, Georgia to through Terre Haute, Indiana. The guy who wrote The Banks of the Wabash by the Sea is from Terre Haute. I learned that while I was passing by because the train stopped and I read the sign on the statue. And I wound up at Leavenworth, where I attended and graduated from Strategic Communication Command, STRATCOM. So I had all of this going on, figuring, okay, even if they send me to Vietnam, you know, with my skills and my talents, you know, and my training, I ain't going to be, man. They sent me.
Not in the rear with the gear.
They sent me over to California. We caught a plane. We made a stop in Japan, flying over Vietnam. I'm looking down and we see this black smoke with these guys coming in because they don't come in and make no long land. They over the water and then they dive in. I'm talking about a 727. And then he dives in and he comes in. We said, man, they must be back rumbling down there. You know what I mean? You know what that black smoke was? The first day I was there, they came in and said, you, and you. Come here.
Burning the shitters?
We called it cooking. Yeah. You know, like the word he said, under glass. And you're stirring it and you pour it. And then they put me on that detail. And when the wind shifted, it was horrible.
Yeah.
They talking about now, you know, they're doing a lot of investigation and they're talking about some burning and things like that.
Yeah, they don't do much better now, which is crazy. You know, we can, you know, have stealth fighter jets, but we're still burning our own feces. You know?
Yeah. And so the next day when they came around to say that, I crawled out under the tent. I crawled, man, over to the side of the little, like, it's like a dirt road, and it was a ditch. And I rolled over in the ditch. And I laid in the ditch till he picked the volunteers to do that. And then when they left, then I got out of the ditch. but that's, I was always thinking.
Yeah, you were smarter than the average guy there for sure.
Hey, you get me again. Yeah. You got me once, same on you.
Yeah, that's right.
You get me with that stick. And they had these double, quadruple hole latrines. Man, them buckets was full. And you got to, you can't just burn it. You got to stir it to make sure it all burns.
Good job. You know, it's like you want to, yeah, the stuff you end up doing in the military, you know, in some cases, whether you're an officer or enlisted, you're like, okay, I joined to, you know, slay the nation's foes. And here I am, you know, picking up trash or burning crap or, you know, all the stuff that doesn't make on the recruiting posters, right?
That's right. I'll tell you a funny story, another one about the military since he's there. I don't know what he would have done if he caught me. So when it was finally time for me to leave, I went down on North Broad. I think it was 401 North Broad, you know, with. And I'm in there and I'm sitting there waiting, you know, to be called to take the oath. This guy comes in and says, you, about 15 guys on the front and 15 guys behind. I'm one of them. He says, stand up. And he said, turn to the right. And he said, follow me. He said, you're in the Marines. Hey, see, their recruitment was a little short. So out of the people who were down there and who had been drafted and whatnot, they were going to just take them some.
Just grab them.
Yeah, just grab them, march them on over to the Marine side, give them the oath, and then they get on the bus or the train. So I got up. I said, no, I'm not going. I said, look, man, I came down here to volunteer. I say, but if I got to, I'm just going to go back home. I'm just going to go. I'd already signed my papers and I had everything. I said, no, I'm just gone. And I walked, man, and I walked out the door, at the side door, and I left it cracked so I could look in. You know, and he just took another guy behind, and they took them all on the left, and I waited till they were gone. Then I went back in, and then they took me over to the Army where I took the oath.
Some poor bastard ended up in Paris Island that wasn't supposed to
be. See, it wasn't me. But all of that meant nothing, because when I got there, they put me in an outpost. Hmm. They stationed me at a little outpost in Tamkee. With Tamkee, it was Benoit. Up and down, it was between Chulai. It was closer to Chulai than it was to Da Nang. Hmm. But it was...
So this is just a small base of some sort? Just out in the in the frontier there?
Yeah. Out in the bush. There was only one road in, one road out.
I've heard stories. I got to be on a fly on the wall having with you and Jack Baker telling stories. You told
Jack
maybe
Baker
this
was a ranger.
He was, yeah. And there was a story you were talking about where you guys were in a base somewhere and the jungle was really dark at night. Can you recall that? Always worried about nodding off or something?
We were on perimeter guard. You go way out. Yep. And then you set up. Afterwards, you dig in and you sit there. This guy sleeps. You stay awake. They had a little bit of that in some of the movies about the guys falling asleep instead of watching. And so it was my turn, and I nodded off. Now, it's like driving a car. You ever nod off while you're driving a car? You don't know how long you were driving down the road sleeping. It was scary,
We call it touch and goes. You're like...
Oh, yeah. That's what the planes do down at the cabin. And so I didn't know how long. And I kept thinking about it. And I'm saying, man, people behind me are depending on me, out here. And did I sleep too long? And then they could be right here in front of me right now. Because night is night in Vietnam.
Yeah, it's dark.
It's a thing called a rolling silence. Are you familiar with the rolling silence? Because insects make noise. There's birds chirping and there's insects. Things are making noise. But as you walk into the area, they all shut up. Mm. Insects, it's a defense mechanism by then. And if there's a significant enough movement, you'll hear the silence and the silence will move. Mm. So that, give you some indication.
Something's there.
So I'm sitting there. Now, first of all, the military, never look at anything directly in the darkness. You had to look side to side, so that your eyes can focus. Otherwise, it looked like the trees are walking toward you. Right. If you look and you stare. Right. So I'm not sure. I'm uncertain. I'm worried about the people behind me. And as you've seen from when I was a child, I'm thinking.
Yeah.
So what's the worst that could happen? Man, we could get wiped out. They could be right here. They could be next to me. I took a cluster flare. Cluster flare? You take the top off. It's about this big. Put it under the bottom. Smack it. And you get a whoosh. And it lights up. It don't last long.
Right.
Man, I fired that flare and gunfire opened up everywhere. Everybody along the perimeter. You saw the tracers, and all that flying and boom. Somebody with an M79, boom. And then it all died down. Said, okay, anybody say anything? Who fired? I never said a word. Now you got me confessing. Can they still get me?
Probably not.
But at
the time you felt it was the prudent thing to do.
But they'll know I'm out here.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know.
I was going to say, if anybody was out there, they were dead.
That's right. and you weigh it against them knowing I'm here and protect and being able to defend and protect, as opposed to they're already here and I blew it. So
you spent a lot of time in Vietnam, and I know from our prior conversations
11 months,
on the air,
3 weeks and 2 days.
Exactly.
Yeah, but who's counting?
Who's counting, right? What did all that time mean to you? What did you learn there?
When I went to Temple, I learned how to fence. Mm-hmm. That's another thing. And I became, I made the last cut. I became a member of the varsity team, Temple University.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is after, this is after Vietnam.
Yeah. And I won the Middle Atlantic FA fencing team championship. And they were doing an interview with me on the paper. I was the MVP that year on the team as well. So they were interviewing me. you know, for, I think it was the Philadelphia Bulletin at the time. It was the Bulletin, it was the Inquirer, and it was the Daily News. Mm-hmm. And they were interviewing me, and I made a comment about having enjoyed something in Vietnam. And the guys in the neighborhood, one was ex-Marine, they said, enjoy? I said, no. But I had to explain it. I said, what it is that I learned something about myself that was really worth the trip. I learned, among other things, that I could be deathly afraid. I mean, have knots in my stomach as big as my fist, that I could be deathly, deathly afraid, but I could still function.
Yep.
And that was all the difference in the world. Mm-hmm. Again, like walking from City Hall home, I learned something about myself in the most dire situation. I mean, an active war.
Yeah.
And you learn that you can function. Because one time they told us we'd pinned down. They said we were surrounded by, they estimated 2,200 NVA regulars with some Charlie in them. And again, I want to go on record as respecting the Viet Cong.
Sure.
They could do more with nothing
right.
than a lot of people do with a whole lot. But anyway, I don't go off on the side. We were taking incendiary grenades. They were melting everything, any files in the base camp, any this, any that. And we were holed up just waiting day and night, you know, for this attack that's supposed to come. They said they couldn't bring in any air cover. So that if worse comes to worse, rather than have them overrun the base, we had to call in what they call VT, you know, where you set the mortar stuff to explode over the air rather than on impact.
It's like air burst. Yeah, it's like a air bursting, you know,
yes. Mortar. And they told us to call that in. And we said, well, what about us? And they said, well, try to find something. If you got any kind of matches and stuff, cover you. It was the philosophy of destroy you to save you, mm-hmm. you know, but really was so that we can't say that Charlie had a victory. And I'm sitting there scared to death. Mm-hmm. And I don't wish that on anybody. I told somebody, if you went to Canada, I could care less. Mm-hmm. If you got a deferment, I could care less. You got to deal with the choice and the decision that you made.
Right.
I made mine, and thank God I survived it, but I learned so much more mm-hmm. about myself.
Yeah, I was going to say, now we got people afraid to go outside without a mask on, but that's another story. So,
hello. See, anyway, I need to interview
I'm going to get us in trouble now. I'm going to get us in trouble now.
So, no. So it's interesting. Our podcast is based on the idea of mastering self, mastering craft, accomplishing any life mission. One of the things that comes up a lot for people, and I'm really glad you brought that piece because I've heard you mention that before, and I'm glad you brought that piece up because people sometimes live for years with fear, and it's not even life-threatening fear. It can be just fear of failure or fear of taking a chance, even something as minimal as that. You're describing you learn to live with a real life-threatening visceral fear. And that's something that when people confront that, at some point they learn that, okay, I can still function. I can still move forward. It's people are capable of achieving many, many things if they will simply decide, okay, here it is. Well, what's the next objective thing I can do?
Well, you know, I've got text messages and all that come into me on the radio station.
Right.
I have one. If I read it to you, they really laid into me. Bob is acting like keep it moving. There's nothing to see here about the virus. And they've closed the county courthouse and schools are shut down and all. And he's acting like there's nothing and nothing. Well, from the onset, I've been looking at the data. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been watching it. There was a story that I saw when I was a young guy. My wife and I was married now, but I was still relatively young, had been back from the service. I was working for a justice on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court as his judicial aide. And we're watching The Jungle Book, the old one mm-hmm. with, I remember the young Sabu or somebody.
Right.
And it's a black and white. And she said, can you really talk to the animals? She called them animals. He called them jungle people because mm-hmm. he was with
right.
And he says, yeah. And she said, then they've got this monkey chained to a perch in her father's tailor shop. And he's going to die chained to this perch in this tailor shop. And so she said, can you talk to him? And he said, sure. He goes, and the monkey, oh, And he goes, and the monkey goes, and he goes, ha, ha, ha. And he goes, and she said, well, what did he say? He said, and I'm going to paraphrase, he said what the monkey people have always said from the beginning of time, and that is, we the monkey people, we are the greatest, the noblest, we were the most productive of all the jungle people. And we know this is true because we always say so. I mean, something hit me in my head sitting on that couch. Is a thing true because it's always said? Mm. It made me look at my religious teachings in church again, measured against what they say as opposed to what the Bible actually says. Right. It made me rethink with politicians. You know, this is what they said. The Democrat Party is for the people. The Democrat Party is for the minority. And then I didn't realize the Democrat Party was the Confederacy. The Democrat Party created the Jim Crow laws, the Black Code. The Democratic Party tried to counter the 13th Amendment, which freed the slave, the 14th Amendment, which gave them equal protection and citizenship, and the 15th Amendment gave them the right to vote way before white women got the right to vote, which wasn't until like, when I read that, but people would say it to this day. Many Blacks and minorities say that.
Yeah.
But these kind of things, you know, hit me, and I'm glad that I can't tell you why. Maybe it was divine favor, but I've always been a seeker.
Yeah.
So having said that, going back to what you asked me, which was, do you remember? Because I'm good at going off a tangent.
Yeah. Which question?
The latest one was about being part of the Philadelphia County Democrats,
yeah.
I think.
Well, he asked that. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I asked you about, you know, how your political journey began. And obviously, you started to allude to.
I did it as a Democrat. My father was a Democrat. Yeah, my mother was a Democrat. They voted Democrat. I voted Democrat. And I didn't like the fact that the Democrats weren't delivering service in the neighborhood I lived to the people who lived in the neighborhood. So one day I went knocking on doors, telling people to vote for different, they call them precinct chairs here, but they're important because they make up a political structure. There's a, you know, the ward leader and then the chairs, and then there's the, this, that, on the, up the hierarchy. So I went and told them to vote, but not for me. I named two other guys and they won. Mm-hmm. And the congressman of the district heard that I had defeated two of his loyalists. Mm-hmm. And he called me to come into the office. And I went into the office and he started hollering and screaming. I started to get up and walk away.
Yeah.
But something said, well, listen to what he has to say first, which I did. Later on, I went to work for him. Because I figured if they weren't delivering, rather than get rid of him, because he had seniority about 16, 18 years, mm-hmm. I would put more demands on the seniority. Mm-hmm. But then by being involved with his power as a congressman, he sent me down to City Hall to go to different people, said, go look up these records and these books of this election from 30 years ago. This, and they knew because he called ahead, the congressman is sending the kid down. You know, give them the key. And they gave me the key to go to the top of City Hall under William Penn's feet. Mm-hmm. They got archives up there. Mm-hmm. And I opened the door and I went in and I was looking for these results when the Republicans was in control. And I ain't been in control for 70 something years now. And I saw two sets of books and I saw this and I saw that. And so they groomed me. They were grooming me. And eventually I ran and became president of Philadelphia County Young Democrats. But ultimately, as I got more and more education in college and wanted to broaden the ideological base of the party, which I thought was the ideological base, I didn't realize it was just power, period.
Right.
They weren't interested in slaves. They were just interested in staying in power.
Right.
But I was on the policy committee. If they don't pick you and endorse you, I don't care who you are, you're going to win in Philadelphia. They had ballots. You have to have street money if you're going to run for office. And that's at least $50 for each of the two precinct chair in there per candidate. That's what the candidates got to pay you.
Right.
They have a morning ballot where you hand them this ballot and people go in with that paper and vote. You got an afternoon where they change it to give somebody took money for a few more. You got the evening ballot, and if the guys want, I mean, it was a machine.
Right.
It was a literal machine.
It's a hell of an education too for you.
I cut my teeth. A
major social education there.
I cut my political teeth, and finally, by being like I was and being able to know. When the congressman, when they had a census, you get a lot of census jobs.
Right.
He let me go around to different areas to the Irish community and offer them jobs. You know, I have some jobs for you people to set me other, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But that's what it was about. And now what they do to contain power in Philadelphia, they create more government jobs. They have all of the jobs from register of will, the clerk of quarter session, common plea, they're political appointees.
I was going to say in the government too, it's the federal side, it's not much different. So we call it the self-licking ice cream cone. So.
Oh, I never heard that before. The self-licking, yeah, we call it patronage.
Yeah, so it's the self-licking ice cream cone of the
federal which government, so. And they know that a president at most the last 8 years, they've been there 30.
Right.
You know, yeah. They slow things down. You've seen what they just did and what they're still doing now. But let me complete my thought here. About how the machine works. What they do now is they create agencies, and when they did the first Obamacare, they created a couple of hundred new agencies in the federal government that's going to be staffed with political people that are loyal to them. They have a housing authority, and I was a deputy in the housing project for what political job,
right?
You know, they have a parking authority from the administration, the people on the street, all jobs, the government job, they pick and they give this guy some and they give you some for you. They even have a trash authority.
Right.
Where they go around and all these people do is like write tickets on the population. Now, because the judge of the traffic court has to ultimately make the decision if you go to court. You pick up the phone,
right.
You know, and say so-and-so is coming down. Sometimes they just dismiss them or find a technical reason. Other times they holler at them, but they still dismiss them. It's all the political machine. Mm-hmm. That's why people keep voting for them.
Right.
Their whole life is intertwined in this sticky netting of the machine.
Right.
Yeah, Bob, did you have one turning point where you did enough like self-discovery?
Yeah, made some money, moved to the suburbs, and became a Republican.
So was it like a series of events? You just kind of grew up and realized that you know everything you had been supporting really didn't reflect your values, or
well, I don't know that everything I was supporting didn't reflect the values. I think it was actually the person that talked to me, and he had met me at a meeting. In fact, John Kerry married his wife after he was killed in a plane in a helicopter crash. His name was Hines. Oh, yeah. Senator Hines is relatively young.
Okay.
He was one of the guys that convinced me that the Republican Party was better suited for somebody that wanted to think and to plan and to do more than just count votes.
Right.
And he convinced me of that. And that's what I did. I became Republican. Although Frank Rizzo, the legendary mayor of Philadelphia, him and I were friends.
They got a statue of him now.
They just took it down. The Black Lives Matter had the city moving.
That's right.
They have stupid behind me. But Rizzo, they had him down as a racist cop because he fought the Black Panthers. Okay, but the Black Panthers actually attacked him. But later on in life, because I found out, look, I know the machine. Politicians take care of the people, take care of them.
Right.
Oh, and then the Black people who line with Franklin, their neighbors and their community, and they got service.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you do. You reward your friends and you punish your enemies.
Right.
That's the nature of the game.
Right.
And later on, he switched parties because I don't go into specifics, but some factions didn't want him. He wanted to run for mayor for a third term. The charter only says two terms.
Uh-huh.
and they challenged him. But they, his people found a loophole that if he switched parties, he wouldn't be running under the, so he could run again.
Oh, I see.
And he ran as a Republican. Now, in Pennsylvania, I know in Philadelphia, you actually register by party.
Okay.
You cannot go and vote for a Republican other than in the general election unless you go down City Hall and change your registration, okay, to Republican. So they are card carrier. And as a part of the machine, they would, if people didn't vote in 2 years and they were to strike off list, I'd get a list of all of those people. And one of my jobs was to go to everybody's house, knock on the door, still live there, and get them re-registered. You know, I'm telling you, it's a machine.
No, that's when you hear about that what you're talking about, Bob, is that ground game we always hear about.
The machine.
Yeah, so it's like still valid today. I mean, you know.
Yeah. And you would, you know, and that's what they would do. It was into how many votes. If you could get 30 votes out of your address, if you had a store or something, you got a better paying job in the political system.
So you think that is that just human nature? When you talk about
the machine. Bible says the heart of man's heart is desperately wicked. Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean,
and just when you congregate enough people together in a location, you just pile them on top of each other in these mega cities, that machine just, it becomes so enmeshed. And the human nature just kind of takes over.
And it's to make them actually dependent, because remember, people wonder about these judges and they're ruling and they stop disinformation. They're run by party. Mm-hmm. It's in their interest. And if they want to move up the food chain from a local judge to a district judge to a circuit court judge to a federal judge, an appeals judge, and anywhere else up the chain, they know that they'll get that chance if their party is in power.
Yeah.
So there's a vested interest for all of them.
I think so many people get cynical about politics and everything. I know it's been a big part of your life, and you've seen it from so many different angles. I think that's what makes your conservative talk show you've had some amazing people on there, and the message has been very consistent over the years. It's always about facts. It's not you're not beating the drum like a, you know, I've heard you jump on the back of Republicans and alike.
Yeah, well,
you know,
all voices should be heard.
That's right.
And let people make up their own mind. Just give them the information.
That's right. And it's not, what I like about that is you're still thinking that part of the radio show. And I think that's what people appreciate that. And I definitely want to get to the radio show. So when you come out, you're in the politics, you've been in politics from the time I first met you. It's been, 15 years or so, at least at this point. You've been in politics a good part of your life in one shape or form. Can you go through that a little bit more?
It's like this. And we didn't talk about all the different jobs.
Right.
I went knocking on doors because when I was back there, you wanted to work.
Right.
You wanted to have a job. You wanted your own money. Whether it was shoveling snow off people's sidewalks for 10, 15 cent or a quarter. Mm-hmm. We love snow days, man, because we go all through the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll shovel your snow for you. Whether it was sweeping up the floor in the barbershop, mm-hmm. or brushing off people with a whisk broom for tips. The barber saw me do that so faithfully, he actually brought a shoe shine stand in, taught me how to shine shoes so I could make even more money because I would be there. I went to ask a guy, you know, I went from store to store to store. One guy had a poultry shop. That's why your chickens is like an affinity. Mm-hmm. And they would take the big, because in a Jewish neighborhood, everything is almost fresh, mm-hmm. at least back then.
Right.
You know, the fish store at the corner where I live, they'd be swimming around, you know, and then on the Jewish house, he would take these big fish out and club them over the head into submission, mm-hmm. you know, before he cut them. Mm-hmm. I mean, we'd be standing there as kids watching this big, you know, and the fresh fruits and the fresh vegetables and the fresh bread every day sliced. And So all of these, and I asked, and they gave me a job delivering chickens. You know, people call, could you give me a chicken? I couldn't handle a chicken. When you pull them out, all of them push back. You pull them out, and you take the feathers, you know, and you cut off his head, turn him upside down, drain him, then put him on this machine to take all his feathers off, and you trim and all that, and put the legs, if they wanted the legs, you put that on the side too, and then wrap it up in the paper and give it to me in a bag. Say, take this to Miss Gazelle, Miss Swartz. And package was warm.
Yeah.
You know, it's a body up there. Yeah, yeah. But I did things because I was always willing to work and learn. And one of the things that the congressman did for me was say, what do you want to do? What kind of job you want? And that's when I went and found out I didn't even know half the jobs that they had, a political job. Uh-huh. Later on as a printer, because I came out of Dobbins as a printer. Remember I told you about the yearbook?
Yep, yep.
I worked for this box company. And they were, you know, printing. And one day they asked me to deliver the mail in this box company. And I went on the third floor and there was a little office, glass office. And there was a guy walking around and I had seen him. So one day I just walked over after I delivered the mail and spoke to him. He said, hi, how you doing? I asked him, what were you doing? Guess what he did? He would design boxes for products. Mm-hmm. It was a box company, but I mean the cardboard box. Right, right. But he would design it because people like me would print it, you know, the Heidelberg, the Mealy, the presses. And then they would have the die cutters cut it, and they had the gluers if it had a cellophane front. He designed that.
Oh, okay.
How do you get a job like that?
Yeah.
How do you even know something like that exists? Mm-hmm. So, my quest for that is when I finally went to college because I didn't ever thought about college. Mm-hmm. And this old guy told me, he said, you ever think about going to college? Said, no. But he talked me into going. And I went, but I hadn't had any SATs or anything. Mm-hmm. But he said, well, if you get a job here, you can go. Mm-hmm. 11 hours.
That's right.
So I got a job. They had just started forming their own police department. Mm-hmm. The security guard, they call them. Okay. And now even the public schools have their own police department right now. And I got hired. And I would walk patrol around the campus, and the campus is surrounded by slums, around the campus from 4 to 12, go home, study a couple of hours, get up in the morning, take my first class at 8, take them down to 12 maybe, and then later on walk up about to 22nd Street from Broad to the congressman office and volunteer to work and do stuff for him and that. So it was really working my way, climbing up, but this is the thing I found out. Life is not about, or if you want to get up in life and get started in life, it's not about what's in it for you. It's who you can help.
That's right.
If you can help somebody, they reward you.
Right.
And I've done that, you know, over and over and over, you know, through my life. But like you said, politics is in everything. I a guy talked me into coming to work with him. He liked me. He saw me. He wanted to get involved in politics. He was a young Italian guy. And he had a car leasing business. And so what he did was he had me come to work for him so that I could introduce him to the politicians, you know? So and it is business because he was leasing to the police, you know, and all that, through the fraternal order.
Right.
And so he brought me in to do politicians when Wilson Good ran. And this was basically illegal. They're not supposed to get donations, corporate, private.
Right.
But every vehicle Wilson needed, he was running as an underdog. But every vehicle he needed, I got him, whether it was a limo drive-in or whether it was a steak body truck. And all, through his name was Chris Carney, John Chris Coney Darnell. Big dealership in South Philly, Chris Coney Oldsmobile. He would get all these vehicles. Do you know when he became mayor? So John taught me the business.
Right.
And then I started my own leasing business. And I used to lease directly to the politicians, you know, and all myself. But when Wilson Good went to lease a vehicle for the city and all, he went to the other guy. He leased from me because he didn't like the fact that I had been a friend of Frank Rizzo. So it didn't matter that Wilson Good was Black.
Right.
Or that I helped him become the first Black mayor. It's the
wrong team.
Wrong team. That's right. Wrong team.
Yeah.
And so
did you, I was going to say, Bob, so how, yeah, I mean, you. So I guess you went to Temple. Is that what you did? Is that
graduated
what
you from Temple University.
Okay. And then, so I guess it'll be, I think it'll be part of the story, but how did you end up going from Philly to the other places you went? Because I think that'll be kind of cool to, you know, weave the story together.
Around 1976, a girl that I had met in church when I was about 8 or 9, she had just moved up from the South, and I was raised in church. And for many years, almost 12 years, you know, things that happened, and I went in the Army and I did this and you know, go to college and you get exposed to drugs. And I mean, you know, just, you know, come back. I stayed in Italy about a year and a half. I used to sing with an Italian band over there, and we used to travel. I used to build myself as ex bassista de Wilson Pickett, you know, but they don't know. And, you know, but they liked Black entertainers. You know, it was Europe and it was Italy and Germany and all them that sustained Black musicians.
Right.
You know, so I did all of that, and I finally come back to the States. And all kind of going on, I'm in politics and all this stuff. There was a strike. And in that strike, the transportation strike, the city would take city employees and drop them off in different neighborhoods close to where they could get a ride. So I'd have them, they'll drop me off in my mother's old neighborhood. I know enough people over there that have cars. They can take me home from there. Mm-hmm. And I got off, they dropped me off at this street. And as I went to walk to my mother's house, I ran into her. Here's this girl that I knew when I was a kid, and while, you know, and I left, I hadn't seen her in years and years and years and years and years. And we talked and found out we were still friends. Mm-hmm. And then we began to converse, and then she would invite me by the house, and her mother was a good cook. Mm-hmm. And somehow I always, you know, when you're a bachelor, you get a meal, well, you can get one, man.
Yes, right.
You know, and I used to stop by. She changed me. She got me to go to church again. She invited me to this concert or something. I went, and then later on I come back, and needless to say, that girl was Gloria.
Yeah, I knew this was the Gloria story.
And I wound up not only going to church again, but I became a member again, and then I was a brother, then I became a junior deacon,
okay.
Then I became an ordained deacon, and then I became a minister, and then a junior pastor, and then I was ordained an elder in Ontario, Canada. And with all of that going on, we were moving further and further out of Philadelphia, mm-hmm. further and further and further and further out. And eventually I became a pastor because I had been an assistant. And there were a number of churches that were available. One in California, they were trying to get me to come out to LA.
Right.
This guy wanted me to take over his church. And somebody offered me a church in Florida. Somebody wanted me to start a church in Redding, Pennsylvania. But we prayed about it. And somebody asked me to come down and preach a revival for a week in Corpus Christi, Texas. Corpus Christi, Texas, what is that? So that's my first time. That was July of 1991. I came to Corpus Christi.
That's how you got to Corpus Christi.
That's how I got to Corpus Christi. To come down just to teach. I didn't know they were talking about pastor. Mm-hmm. Then later on, they asked me if I would accept an assignment down there. And Gloria said, what about it? What do you think about the place? I said, the lifestyle. I said, and the weather and all. I said, you can live a long time down there in South Texas, Corpus Christi. So we prayed about it, and both of us got the same answer at the same time, Corpus Christi. Mm-hmm. And so we came mm-hmm. to pass a little small church. And the funny story is when I first got there, some of the Black police officers went to Henry Garrett, who was the mayor at the time,
yep.
and said, chief, he said, because he told me this story himself. Mm-hmm. He said, chief, he said, there's a new pastor in town. I said, so what? He said, he's from Philadelphia. What are we going to do?
Yeah.
He was like, I'm some gangster.
It's not legal. Yeah, it's not legal or something.
Yeah,
Henry said he told him, I don't know, watch him, I guess.
Yeah.
And then I started the, you know, TCS Advisory Council, and I got the first neighbor care clinic built there. Mm-hmm. I told somebody, I said, what's your name? I said, my name is Help, and I'm on the way.
Yeah. So this is where I mentioned in the intro about the public servant. I know you were doing the housing work. You've got a whole list of things. Can you kind of touch on some of those things?
Well, you know, the bottom line is most people need help.
Right.
The fact is, they need financial help,
right?
You know, but unless they have some other way to sustain them, you can't sustain them. Mm-hmm. So you try to do things that are benefit. When I went to the North Side, they said it was over, it was ended, it was dead. Harold Branch and some of those old stallions, you know, they came and talked to me and we met. And I was trying to tell them about the strength in numbers. You can't just be a group of you as leaders. And if you can't back it up, they don't care about what you said. I mean, it only had a 4% Black population to start with. And this got to be for everybody. The neighbor care clinic, the Oville Williams wasn't built. I went to Betty Jean Longoria, who at the time was a city councilwoman. And I told Betty, I said, look, man, you know, these people need this. And they, Tom Utter, who was over some part in the city department, and nothing happened without him. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was in total control. In fact, when I first met him, he invited me over to the cut in the north side to eat some soul food, just to show me he was down with it. He was from South Carolina, I believe. But she fought him, kept $370,000 that was designated that Tom was getting ready to move because they had plans that they weren't telling people about. Anyway, make a long story short, she kept it there. I went on the RTA board. Remember, I came in 1991. By 1994, I was a unanimous pick for the Regional Transportation Authority Board of Directors. Mm-hmm. And Tom, the scholar at that time, who later became the head of the Metropolitan Planning Organization that deals with priorities for federal, you know, applying for federal money, he said, Betty Turner, former mayor, sent somebody to get me to tell me to go sign up for Leadership Corpus Christi class.
Okay.
And I said, why? And then Harry Williams, who later was on the school board, he's still a pastor at a church. Harry said, come on. He sent him and Lamont Taylor to come and get me. And I said, look, they said, we went and it was a great experience. I said, well, why invent the wheel? Betty Turner said, look, if you're gonna be as active as you are, you need to know the history. You need to know the players. You need to know the lay of the land. That's what she said.
Gotta know what the teams are.
Yeah.
She's trying to help you. She's trying to help you figure
out. You always say that, but it's always true. Hey, you don't have to be a team player. Mm-hmm. Is really what she was saying. And I started functioning with the Democrats down here until people like Philemon Vaila, who's now a congressman, Democratic congressman. And remember this, he was a Democrat kingmaker down here, raised money, got people, women elected to judgeships and all. He was a Democrat power broker until the power broker, which was family oriented too. You know, you had to be part of a certain family.
Right.
You know, your family, you could have a commissioner, you can have a council person, you can have a state representative, all connected to the same family. They call it the patron system down here.
And well, I was going to say, yeah, Bob, one of the things, so my family moved down there in the late 70s, early 80s. And, you know, I grew up pretty much in a Democratic family too. But then I think the Democrats in the time that you're talking about were more like JFK style Democrats, whereas like at some point, I don't know if there was a year or a line in the sand where, you know, even my family that ended up working in the oil industry kind of naturally, I guess you'd say, matriculated to become Republicans because they realized at some point they woke up one day and they're like, man, they don't represent anything that they used to.
Well, if they're promising to give you and you need it, but once you have it, they decide they're going to take from you to give to the next guy. It changes your perspective.
For sure.
It changes your perspective quite a bit. But what got me was, and John Bell was the head of the party and them at the time, is that Philemon Vaila, Carlos Chuan, the attorney Rene Rodriguez, all they told me, don't think about being political, running for any office and stuff down here. They said, because it's our turn now, meaning Hispanics.
Right.
And they told me that at the time, Carl Lewis, who was a judge, and he later became judge over the Children's Family Court, but he had a leaking aorta or something like that. They said, he's the last Black to ever be elected to anything. Well, I proved him wrong when I helped get Harry Williams elected to the school board. Mm-hmm. But I said, well, fine, if you don't want me, I'll go somewhere else. And I found the Republican Party down here, Joel Yowler, and they were meeting in a phone booth. But what they didn't understand was the power of radio.
Right.
I got a job on the radio. Mm-hmm. And as a conservative on the radio, people got to hear another take, another point of view. I became the voice of conservatism in South Texas. And they could look, so much so that Trump won the Wasatch County twice.
Right.
Twice, 2016 and again in 2020. And that is almost evenly divided. That took a lot of work. And some of it moved into the valley and into those areas. So, but I left. And when I left, I was told I had, and I won't name their names. One's a wealthy man. The other one is a politically active Democrat lawyer. They offered to fund a campaign for me to become the district clerk in Nueces County.
Okay.
They asked me to lunch, and I met, and they said, but they only had one stipulation. They wanted me to disavow Republican Party and tell them that I'm a Democrat and I'm turning to the Democrat Party.
Right.
And I said to them, I said, my being involved with the Republican Party is not for political expediency. I said, they best represent my values.
Right.
Not all together, but they best represent my values. Later on, somebody like our mayor, former mayor, Joe McComb,
right.
He ran against Lloyd Neal for the Republican nomination. Kind of, Lloyd announced that he was running, and he made some mistakes because he waited too long, because he always ran nonpartisan. When Lloyd ran, this same guy came to Lloyd, up to Joe McComb, said, we'll back you to run against him. Now, he told me, well, I'm sorry about it, because I only back Democrats, okay? And he first approached me at a Rotary meeting. I used to be a member of the downtown Rotary. And he approached me and said, I only back Democrats. So when he started McComb's campaign off with 7,500. McComb beat Lloyd Neal because people knew him to be a longtime Republican. They weren't sure. And in the general election, this same guy, they killed Joe McComb. They ran doctored tapes of him on the commissioner's court and stuff. And that's how Terry Shamsie, out of nowhere, became county judge. And Terry wanted to put somebody from the Mideast on the port commission because he's a Muslim. He wanted to put a Muslim, not only a Muslim, but a Muslim from the Mideast. His wife, Nanette Hassett, just got reelected to another term as a judge because these lawyers put their wives on the bench and then they refer cases to other lawyers so that they're not accused of prayer. I mean, I'm telling you,
local politics is in a lot of ways more interesting. Like, national politics has become just so much about money and, like, you know, staying on the message. But local politics is like
always has been.
It's a TV show.
It always has been. You can do a TV show on it. I know I can certainly give a script.
Yeah.
But as you said, so my involvement in politics has gone a number of routes. But mostly to the fact, like, you know, about 2 years ago, I broke all official ties with the Republican Party.
Okay.
I was on the Senate Republican Executive Committee for 4 2-year terms, 8 years in a row.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have, I even resigned and wouldn't run. Well, I didn't, I did resign, and then I wouldn't run for reelection as a precinct chair or anything.
Right.
Because people are not willing or knowledgeable enough to be able to put it into work to make that office function.
Right.
You got more effort, conservative effort, from the Latinos for Trump than you did from the Nueces County Republican Party.
Mm.
In fact, many people started joining them because they had this motorcade and they had this prayer meeting and they had this guest come in and they had the other. But most people don't understand. They say, and I think, Chris, you'll agree with me, they say the two things that you don't want to talk about is politics and religion.
For sure.
Because you'll get an argument and you'll get, let me tell you something. The two most important things that you can talk about in your life is politics and religion. Because religion is what your value system is. It's your pole star. It's what your mores, your ethics. It's what you believe. It's how you live your life. Religion, what is your religious faith? And politics is how your religious faith transforms into the decisions you make. How do you believe in God and that God created heaven and earth and male and female and all souls are his, and back a party that believes in killing unborn human beings? I mean, how do you support a party that's for euthanasia for old people, or support a party that believes in recreational drugs for young people whose brains are still developing? I think maybe 26, 27, 28, you know, come on, drugs. You're not going to hire somebody to work for you. It's not at a refinery, not at a plant, maybe not even an office. I mean, how do you back a party that says that two men should have sex with each other? For what purpose? I mean, how do you, and tell me that your faith, your religious, your value system is that you believe in God and that you're a Christian. So, but nobody says talk about it. Don't talk about that.
Right. You think it's changed? Well, I know it's changed, but I get, I want your perspective on how you can't, well, you can, but there's not, it's not the same to be able to sit in the same room with somebody that has an opposing view. Because everything you just said, there's people that have an opposing view to it. Some mm-hmm. do. But the civility of being able to have a conversation point by point is very different than it's been. You've seen that change on the radio, I think, over the years, haven't
well,
you?
Well, I've been taught, this is what I was taught. And like I said, a lot of my lessons, I had a guy from India tell me, you know, a lot of Black people, when they talk, they're always moving and shaking their head. I want you to learn to talk and just talk without moving your head, without any head movement.
Right.
And paid attention to that. Somebody told me, said, you said, I be. I had to function on conjugating the verb to be. Because, you know, you're talking on the street and it's slang.
Yeah.
And
right.
Somebody else called me and said, look, he said, you don't have to impress anybody with what you know or that the information you have, because you're not trying to impress them, but you're trying to let them know that they should consider it.
Right.
So in a way, you're trying to impress them.
Right.
He said, look, listen to what everybody else has to say first. I don't care, two people, three people, four, listen. And then when you speak, you're the one that has heard all the positions and you can add, but keep it simple, keep it basic, because it's not that they need to hear it because they're locked in to their position. It's for the audience
right.
to be able to digest it. And it's better if you give it in bites mm-hmm. than if you try to pour it down and give it to them out of a fire hose.
Yep.
And so, you know, I apply that in everything. Mm-hmm. You know, like the kid in class that asked something and trying to be smart. Hey, you know, he's not going to pay attention. You know, he's not going to care, but you've got other people sitting in there. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that you want to reach, and you don't want to get into a long diatribe
right.
or a long explanation. Pop, 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 pop. This. And people go like, and it's true. Mm-hmm. You're not making them digest too much.
Yeah. I mean, there's people that are very rigid in whatever position they're in that you're not going to change them. They're not going to hear your point, whether it's valid or not. And then you do. But I think there's a group in the middle that are willing to think.
Yeah, but
consider.
These people on the end.
Yeah.
I'm a fencer.
Right.
You use them as a foil. Mm-hmm. You use them in that rigidity to feed off of. Mm-hmm. And you can show their rigidity because, for instance, you get approached and somebody said, look, you know, I mean, you have to do so and so and so and so. Marriage is for basically a biblical thing out of for procreation, mm-hmm. be fruitful and multiply, and family is the first political group that you have, you know, with a head
right.
and support. And they said, yeah, well, that's your truth. Mm-hmm. So that's not my truth.
Right.
And I'm saying, no, but that is true. If you look around the world and look at cultures and country, they understood, man. He said, there's no such thing as absolute truth. And I thought, and you know what I said? Is that absolutely true?
Yeah.
And he didn't have no answer.
Right.
Well, I was going to say, Bob, I think one of the things, a good point that you're making out of that, or a point I'm taking out of that is, you know, I think that's part of the problem with debate when this whole concept of that's your truth and this is my truth. And it's like, if we can't even agree that there's objective truth, it makes it really hard to have a real conversation with people, right? I mean, you can't, and the worst thing about it is the extremes are the loudest out of both sides of the debate. So you got a combination of extremes being loud and then not willing to admit that black is black and white is white and the water is wet and
science.
Sand is, yeah. If we can't even agree.
Consensus science.
Yeah. I mean, even like Jordan Peterson gets a bad rap, but he has a science background, you know, a clinician essentially. And he's going back to like lobsters. Like one of the things he talks about, it's like how, you know, male and female lobsters behave and how they develop to show an example in nature that should be objective. And he gets, you know, completely kicked off of his platforms and vilified because he's trying to make a scientific provable fact about, you know, his opinion on the world. And they're like, you know,
that's the point of their being loud, to drown out truth. That's so that they're loud. But listen, Jordan Peterson says lobster. I say, I don't care what medicine you take. I don't care what drug you take. I don't care what clothes you wear. I don't care what medical surgical procedure you do on yourself. A biological male can never become a biological female. That's science.
It's the cellular level. And I think he's made that point. It's just like, you know, you can modify and you can take hormones, but if you look at that person's cells, their body chemistry.
But see, that's too deep. If I'm in a debate and I start going into cellular to get the general understanding, I can't go out to the cellular. I can go into a man doesn't have a womb.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And a woman can't produce sperm. Keep it so that the masses can understand, because the whole thing is to dumb them down. Silence. Now, we talk about the propaganda and what they say, but what's worse is the propaganda of silence. Mm-hmm. And that's what you see going on now, withholding information. And the Bible says, my people perish for lack of knowledge. Lack of information, lack of knowledge. And so, but to give it to them, because you got the loud ones, as you pointed out, Chris, you got the other side is trying to bring it, and you got those in the middle, and those in the middle are afraid to really take a vocal outward position because they know how punitive the loudmouths are and can be.
Right.
Which is why they were shocked when 63 million people ousted Hillary. It was a coronation for her. They were also shocked when 10 million more people joined their ranks less than 4 years later.
Right.
And they're going to be outraged again with this, what they're doing now. That's what I believe.
Well, you know, and Bob, I want to get into how you made that jump into radio. But one of the things that I was just going to tell you is somebody who, you know, we all have our own beliefs, but I think I have gone to two sources to try to find actual information. I don't even call it news anymore. And the two sources that I found the best at getting objective facts, one are through financial information resources, right? So like the kind of information that hedge funds and, you know, financiers go to, like, because you think about it, if you're going to make and invest money, you have to find, you know, the root of the issue. Mm-hmm. You have to get information that is objectively true if you're going to put billions of dollars against it. The other source, obviously being in the military, are sources that focus on, you know, military relations and, you know, government, you know, peer-to-peer competitions in a military realm. Because you think about it, you know, money and military concerns are really, I think, one of the very few places left where you can actually get some information that's raw and believable, because those are the two things, you know, even though people try to interject politics and everything, it's like, if you're going to invest money or if there's people's lives at stake, a lot of that information is the news that I go to, because sadly, you know, you can't even go to, you know, Fox or CNN or some of these other sources and not have it so filtered that you don't know what to believe. And so it's kind of sad state of affairs. And, you know, you'd be on the radio talking about these issues. I know you see it, but yeah, I just wanted to interject that and then maybe use that as a way to springboard and telling us like how you kind of made that jump into radio.
Well, listening to what you said about the raw information, a lot of people get raw information and still come off wrong.
Sure.
A lot of people get raw information and try to maneuver it. First of all, you have to understand my background. I'm a political scientist by degree.
Mm-hmm.
So I've studied everything from the politics of poverty, how poverty is a functional necessity of government, that somebody poor may not get the best doctor, but if there's 300 people in a medical class and somebody graduates number 300, what do you call that last guy? You call him doctor. You don't get the best care, but you get some care as opposed to no care. Rather than write off a huge loss because a button is crooked on a shirt, or there's a stitch somewhere that's not crooked, you buy those. They call them seconds. So they still don't have a total loss, but you wind up having a nice new shirt that you got to really be looking at hard. Same thing for jobs and positions, you know, that normally some people wouldn't do. So I took courses like the politics of power, and power can be laid out in equations, actual equations that deal with power, who has it. I've gone through everybody from Machiavelli to Sun Tzu to other obscure guys. So when you talk about the military facts, because right now the military has been infiltrated, that I truly believe that. You can't say it. Don't shake your head or nothing. Somebody might be looking at you. but even them, you know, because there's generals that love God, home, family, and country. And then there's generals who love promotion, you know, and they'll kowtow to do what they need to do to move up the ranks and this, that, and the other. We've seen that. But back to the point, when I came to Corpus, I had done a little 15-minute a day broadcast back in Pennsylvania that went through Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, and another little, I don't know. And it was called SOAR Ministries. We call it a Spirit Outreach for Apostolic Revival, S-O-A-R. Because I heard a guy say, hey, look, if even Christianity is not on the same track, and the Episcopalians got their thing, and the Methodists got their thing, and the Catholics got their thing, and the Baptists got their thing, and the Lutheran, he said, look, we need everybody to get rid of our thing, go back to the Bible, start with the apostles, get their thing, and let's be on the same page, because it says that they continued in fasting and prayer and the teachings of the apostles, and that they became one. The division came when everybody got to split up. I don't like this one. I think this. I don't agree with that. Anyway, so I had that little bit of experience. Mm-hmm. I came to Texas, and I was on the RTA board, and Bernie Seal used to have a popular morning show. Bernie Seal, and I've adopted a little of that in my style, because he was like standing on the street corner with the whole neighborhood and everybody having at it. Yeah. Except if Bernie didn't like what you say, he unplugged you, he hang up, he fancy. he didn't care at all. And he brought me on to talk about the RTA, the Regional Transportation Authority, of which I was on the board. Mm-hmm. And so they asked me to come in. I think I might've been chairing, or maybe at the operations committee or something, but. So I'm going on radio to tell him, because people, there's empty buses. We don't need no public transportation. Da, da, da. People don't understand that when companies and all move, they want to know if you have a transportation system. They can get people to and from. They want to know all that. They also didn't understand. And I said this one day on Bernie's show. They say empty buses. I said, look, right now, the way the buses are, they start in Robstown. They come down through Cal Allen. They circle through Annaville. They come down through the north side, go through the downtown, circle out, get some of the west side, head out to the south side, and go down to Flower Bluff. I said, that's a long ride. I said, at some point along the ride, the bus going to be empty. I said, but that's no reason to get rid of it. And the guy said, yeah, but it's empty. I said, look, then get rid of all your churches. Ain't nobody in there but on Sunday morning and Wednesday night. And man, the phone lines lit up.
Yep.
And
that's called good radio.
The phone lines lit up. So one day, Bernie invited me back. He had me on 3 hours that morning. Invited me back for another couple of hours. And so one day, Bernie had to go on emergency to Colorado, and he didn't want nobody. Harold McClintus had a show after him, and this, he didn't want nobody but Bob Jones to fill in. And they taught me the clock and what to say, intro and outro. And I was on, and I remember one of the first calls that came into me, and they said, I was telling them, you know, just chatting with the audience, getting used to, because I'm a people person. I grew up that way. And I'm talking about going up to the Alsatian Inn in Castroville because I wanted to try some real schnitzel and I understood it. And I said, so my wife and I said, we went up to Bexar County. Bexar. Yeah. Man, the phone just on there. Bro, Bob, that's Bar County. I am back on Bauer County. In your phone. Okay, next one. Señor Bar. It is no Bauer County. It is Bejar. It is named after Generalissimo San Antonio de Bejar. And filming up again. Well, Bob, you tell him we won. It's Bauer. And it went on and on and on and on and on. So when Harold left to run for state representative, they asked me when I take his 1 hour show. And that was the beginning of it. And I did his show. And at the end of his show, at the end of a month, they let me go. They brought somebody else in. And man, the fax lines, the telephone lines, the phone call, the people wanted me back.
By popular demand, we want Bob.
We want Bob. And that's how they gave me my own show.
How long have you been on the radio now? I mean, your own show, the Bob Jones Show. How long has that been?
Well, the first show I had, I called it Common Sense.
Oh, that's right. I do remember that, yeah.
It was named after Rene Descartes, not Thomas Paine. Mm-hmm. Rene Descartes, who was sort of a Renaissance person,
right.
He said that armed with only the word of God and common sense, a person can determine right from wrong. And that's what I did.
Yeah.
And then at some point I left the radio, I came back, and I was the only one that has ever left the radio that the owners brought back. Mm-hmm. And when they brought me back, they said, common sense returns to 1440 Keys. Yes. That's funny, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I did a 3 hour show on Saturday. And then later on, when they brought me back during the week show, because the guy and the host had left and they brought me to fill in on the morning show. I said, that's too much politics. Cause that one on Saturday was like going in the back alley and slugging it out on one subject for three straight hours, you know? And some people like that, but I thought it was too much and I turned it into a music show.
Yeah, I remember that. I do remember that.
Yeah.
You know, it's I have a lot of respect. I mean, the media that Chris and I use with the podcast here is quite different. But what's interesting to me, I've done some radio with you, and live radio is a different creature altogether. I feel okay with it because as a physician, I'm used to, like you, I'm used to communicating with people, and if they tell me something new, I adapt what I know and just, you know, kind of go.
Chris, I got a story on this guy.
Oh, here comes.
You want to hear the story?
Yeah, I do.
One of the things that I even tell my guests, and I try to do it, like a politician that I'm interviewing, I tell them, I say, look, don't come in here with a stump speech. Yeah. Like you're standing on, you're talking, generalizing to a crowd. I said, recognize this, that I'm riding in the car with these people. I'm up close and personal. Mm-hmm. I'm at their home, at their dinner table. I'm at the plant while they're working. And I'm saying that we're up close and personal. I'm talking to them. I'm not talking at them.
Sure.
And I said, so don't come on trying to do that. I said, so listen, we're not even going to talk about your campaign. I'm going to humanize you first. Mm-hmm. Who are you? What was your childhood like? What did you want to be? Where did you go to school? You know, I'm going to humanize you first and then identify, and then we'll move into it. And then I'll say, you know, well, why did you doing this? And why are you? So when with what I have on air talent, like when he came on and he started a thing, and it was called,
it was the Keys to Health.
No, it was Focus on Health.
Focus on Health, yeah, we called it that. And at some point it was like,
then it became the Keys to Health.
1440 Keys to Health, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but it was, now it's just Keys to Health.
Yeah.
We don't say, because we're on the FM
right,
too
right,
now.
Right.
But it was Focus on Health. And he would come in, because I was intrigued. See, I don't bring them on unless they intrigue me.
For sure.
If they interest me, then I'm saying I got to have a way to get this to the masses.
Right.
I got to take this to a place that they don't have access to and give them my airwaves access to get it on. And he was really, 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 really good. And but the thing is, he had his material, he had it. And I don't know if he was more focused on making sure he got the material out and said it and make sure. So I had an emergency. So I said, I'll be right back.
Well,
he was in the middle of his segment.
I know where he's going.
And he's in there talking and he's going on. And so we see this. And if you take it, so I slip out the door and I close the door, and it's just him and the microphone.
Oh, man.
Tell him what.
So you looked up
and he was gone, and you're like, it's your show now.
Well, yeah, I looked up, and he's gone. I'm like, where? Because I didn't really know. Well, how long is he going to be gone? So there's this, like, you know, and that's what I was getting at when I brought this up about the to sit in a room, a cubicle, and you have to, you're entertaining and informing, not just entertainment, but informing. But I was used to you were kind of supporting me along there. So I realized.
Well, yeah, I'll keep you on point. Yeah, and I'll ask a question that I think the listener wants. I'll ask you to explain a little bit more, you know, the term that you use.
But this scenario, in that scenario, I was kind of like, oh my gosh, I've got to keep this rolling. You know, so I don't even know what I said.
I figured
it must have sounded okay. I must have sounded okay.
And he said, I came back and he said, don't ever do that again.
Yeah. And well, it's funny.
Yeah, did you have an actual emergency or are you just setting him
up? No, I did. I didn't set him up.
I thought he was going to get coffee or something. He took a coffee break right in the middle of his show. You know?
Yeah, while I was sitting there and getting him ready, I didn't go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
So I figured, I don't know if I could wait to the next break, which is like 11 minutes.
Yeah.
So he was like 3 minutes in. Well, he's got enough to talk about in the next couple of minutes at least. But he was like,
But it has a rhythm to it, I guess.
It has a rhythm.
Now, after being on with you, I did it for a year or two with you. It seemed like I understood the flow. I knew that I knew the breaks. I knew how much information I could convey. And I knew when I would just say, let's just let that hang a little bit. Let people call and we'll chat about that.
That's right.
And that was valuable. And so and you've done that with, you know, obviously conservative talk radio, you've done that with all kinds of different topics, both local. You also were a little bit different in a sense that the show is local, but also you do a lot of national things.
I do a national style talk show on a local level,
right?
Because, you know, one of the guys, the guy that I took his place after he went to another station, when I was first on the radio, he had left. And he had made a trip and he had come back and they had made him program director. So he came in one day and told me, he said, I don't like your show. I said, what am I doing? He says, it sounds like you're teaching a college class. Mm-hmm. He said, this is not a market for that. And I said, he said, let me give an example. I said, what do you mean? He said, they just raised the speed limit. The federal from 55 to 70. What would you talk about? I said, well, I talk about the federal government without any consultation, anybody in the local level. It's equal to another federal mandate. Mm-hmm. Things have to be done and signs and people have to be. I said, it's unfunded as a mandate. Mm-hmm. I said, the effect on the local level, because they rate lowered it to 55 merely to save gas.
Right.
And he said, see, that's what I'm talking about. You're giving this back. I said, well, what would you talk about? He said, what you should be talking about is how much easier it is for dogs to fall off the back of pickup trucks at a higher speed.
Wow.
and to this day, and because I told the owners, I said, look, we got a university now. And it wasn't there. We didn't have a four-year university when I came to Corpus Christi. We have a four-year university. We've got not corporate headquarters, but regional headquarters. We're graduating kids. We've got a more intelligent population. We're expanding. We're growing. I said, people want to weigh in on all kinds of issues. They don't get to weigh in on a national show. How often do they get to weigh in or call to tell you what I think or whatnot? So I do it, but I don't limit it because I don't want to bore myself. I do local, state, national, international. I do history. I do science. I do language. I do religion. I do politics. And then sometimes I just do anything. Like I got in one time and talked about my car. I said, you know, a funny thing. I was thinking today about my first car. It was a Bonneville, Plymouth Bonneville. Mm-hmm. And I said, I had stereo AM. Well, that's because of the speaker.
Right.
And then I started talking about the parts of the car. And because all I ever did was drive a car. Now I'm talking to people. And people are out on the highway in the rush hours. And
they're interested because it applies to a lot of people.
Yes. And I'm sitting there talking about how I had a friend named Larry Higgs who used to work on my cars for me. And one day, you know, I had it squealing. you know, and he said, I needed the brake pads. So I asked him, could you do it for me, Larry? When he took the cap off, you know, that big cylinder off, he said the cylinder fell in half because I had worn the brake pad down to like the rivet, and the rivet pressure on the inside was almost like a torch that had split the thing. And he used to crack up. He told me, you know, he said that I put a hole in the point. I still don't know what a point is. You know, points and plugs.
Yep.
He said, put a hole in the point. Is that bad?
It's bad.
See, one time he told me how to change. He said, look, I want you to do some of this for yourself. I want you to change the oil. So I don't know what he said, but I did remember he said, it'll take 6 quarts to put back in. And so I put the 6 quarts in, and I'm riding down Benjamin Franklin Parkway, and the car goes, bam, bam. I never took any oil out.
It's like hydraulic oil.
And so
piston can't even move.
Talking like that, man, the phone jumped off the hook. And even now, and that was more than about 2 years ago, even now, if I replay that, they start calling in about when the high beam used to be the button on the floor on the one they had. And they talk about their first, and because it's a common topic.
Right.
And so
I was going to say, Bob, I remember doing one show with Dr. Curtis in studio with you.
Yes.
And the cool thing about it is, you know, I'm like Bill, my job, I'm used to talking to people in all different types of settings and giving presentations. So I was comfortable, but I think to make the point of what you're saying, I think the format of your show and your ability to shift on different topics, no matter who the guests are, you know, I know for me being a newbie, it made it a lot easier because I felt like you were engaged immediately with what we were talking about. And I could see how that makes your show more interesting to listen to because it's not just national or just, you know, topic A. So I think it's cool that for the people, you know, in a kind of a mid-sized market of Corpus, get a chance to, you know, have somebody.
We're right in the middle of the size of the market. But I do remember one man I had on, and he asked his good friend and associate, listen and tell them what they thought about the show.
Yeah.
And she said, it sounds like two friends having an interesting, really conversation, and I get to listen in.
That's perfect.
But what talk radio adds is that you can listen. You can join in too.
Right.
Via text, via call. And you'd be surprised because when you're saying something, see, and that's the difference in a podcast. They don't get the feedback on you.
Yeah, it's true.
Not as directly. it's a little more indirect.
But people, you say something, and their mind goes to a whole nother place.
Sure.
Something it triggers in their mind, then they try to come back around again.
Right.
So, but it is. It's basically having an interesting conversation that people want to listen into.
Perfect. Yeah, I was going to say, do you have any, it's been a while since I've been back home, and sometimes I will tune in your show through the wonder of modern technology and apps. I can listen to you sometimes. But is there any other local talk show hosts that have like another side to you or to, you know, it's kind of like the.
ABC, NBC, CBS, ABC, on the radio, you got NPR, you got,
I didn't know if there was like another local voice. I mean, you're pretty much, is there any other local?
Well, there's a country station.
Yeah,
that does country music, but for 3 hours in the morning, Lago goes on there. He's on the country station. So, but he's not contrary to me. He's just all local. That's all he does is local stuff.
Yeah.
The one that he had has Glenn Beck, so they have a national local. I'm the only other local, and now we're the only 24-hour-day, 7-day-a-week talk radio on FM.
Cool.
So they don't even have that, but. I bring them on. I bring the Democrats on. I bring the Libertarians on. I bring the commies on. I've had the commies. They don't want to come on now because they don't want to talk.
Yeah, they don't want to. They don't want the debate. Yeah. What's the? I was gonna say as we kind of get near the end. What is the? You've had a pretty interesting career. You've had amazing guests on. tell us about a couple of the interviews that mean the most to you in your career. Oh, okay.
Well, one, I blew everybody out the water because I had Hillary Clinton on. Wow. And I had done enough about Hillary that that I knew that in the Kennedy years and all, she had come down into the valley, and they were registering votes, voters and all that stuff. So I knew about that. I talked to her beforehand and told her three things that I was going to ask her. But I'd also tried to reach Barack Obama when he was running. Mm-hmm. Some young snot gets on the phone and says, "What? You want to talk to the man himself?" It was like idol worship. I mean, but that's what he said. So my point was, okay, he doesn't have to come on. So Hillary comes on and we chat and we talk and she laughs. She did that really laugh. I have to let you hear that one day. And she was talking about it. So I asked her, about, many women, the first president or the female. And she said, well, a lot of heads of states, and we got into a little decent conversation, they're parliamentary procedures. So if you head your party and the party gets the largest sled, then it's the party that makes you the head, you know, whether it's Indira Gandhi or you know, a number of other women. But she also got into how they're more used to it. And even in Britain with Thatcher, it was because they were the head of their party and their party won the election.
Right.
But we talked about it. And another one, and that got me a lot of Democrat listeners realize that I would do that. And she killed Obama in Nueces County in South Texas. I'm not saying it's because she was on the show,
right?
But it sure didn't hurt her.
Yeah, I'll say well, sure it didn't hurt.
She came and communicated with the community.
Yeah, another one that I had was Bill Cosby. I had him on twice. We both graduated from Temple University. I remember telling him one time, I said, yeah, your picture is hanging in full color, big picture over in McGonagall Hall. I said, mine is underneath your picture, but it's a smaller one and it's black and white because of the varsity fencing team and all. He says, well, because he was a big benefactor. He says, well, I don't know why my picture is up there big and in color. I said, yeah, well, I know why mine is little and in black and white. but we were talking about education, and it was a young girl from West Oso High who had gotten a scholarship to a major university, I think A&M, College Station. And we were talking about it, and he asked her, what did your father have to say? And she said, my father doesn't know. He left us. And Bill Cosby said from his, he was on the phone. He says, I want everybody to stop what you're doing. I want everybody. And I want you all to listen to the pain in her voice. I want you to hear. I mean, it was the guys in the studio, the producer, the technician, man, they had tears in their eyes. Mm-hmm. Here's someone that achieved something tremendous. And the dad wasn't around to enjoy it. I've interviewed so many different people, federal level, local level, politicians, but the Cosby interview, in fact, he said one time, and man, everybody killed me. They called me and texted me. He said, all right, if you need anything, just give me a call and ask me for my money, he said. Oh, Lord, don't say that. They coming to me because they ain't got his home phone number. You know, I do. You asking me about some other points that we had on the radio? You asked me other individuals.
I was going to say, one of the things I was curious about, so you mentioned, Dr. Curtis mentioned about people you interview, but I'm curious, I know you've had a very interesting life. How about somebody you've met in person that had an impact on you? Somebody, I mean, all of us have, by the time we get of a certain age, you kind of- Frank Rizzo.
Democrat, Philadelphia Mayor Frank Rizzo. They said he was racist and all of that. I knew that not to be true. Listen, I called Frank Rizzo up one day. You're talking about influences in my life, right?
People you met had an impact on you.
Well, I met him. I met Muhammad Ali. I might have had a bigger impact on him than he had on me because of what he asked me to give him some advice on. And I know that's another story for another day. But Frank Rizzo, I went up, I said, look, I need to talk to you. You know, I had a list of, you know, constituents, you know, they needed some stuff. So he said, come on up. So I went up to his mansion that Al Perlman had built for him and stuff. And everybody sits, whenever you go to his house, you sit around the table. His wife, Carmela, brings in all these cold cuts and meat and fruits. And you always eat first in Italian. Right, and then you talk business. You know, he had this guy around, one is the city manager. And he said, you know, they were always plotting the takeover of the world, you know. And it worked because he ran for mayor again later as a Republican and won. Right. But he died that summer after he had won. But anyway, he taught me some stuff. So let me give an example. I'm sitting there and finally says, he always made the guy move and had me sit right next to him all the time. So he puts his glasses and goes, what do you need, Bobby? And I said, I went to my pocket. Took out this piece of paper, I folded it and unfolded it. It was folded in fours, I never forget. And I opened it. I said, well, number one, number eight. He said, whoa, 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 what's that? I said, it's a list. He said, a list? I said, yeah, well, first of all, I didn't want to forget what I was going to talk to you about because, right. You know, your time is valuable and limited. And then if I didn't get to talk about it all, I prioritized it so I could talk about the first thing, the second thing, the third. Maybe I might only get to three or four. And I said, and then again, he said, Bobby, Bobby, Bobby. Mm-hmm. He said, Bobby, let me tell you something. He said, everybody that ever went to jail had a list. and everybody at the table started laughing.
Yeah, yeah.
He said, don't you know how they do it? They find out you got a list, they subpoena your list, and then they send you to jail with what you wrote down.
Right, right.
He said, look, I'm Italian. I grew up in Italian. He said, in my first grade class, somebody grew up to be a policeman. Somebody grew up to be a union leader. He said, somebody grew up to be a nun. He said, somebody grew up to be a glazer. He said, and some grew up to be in the mafia. He said, because in the Italian neighborhood, mafia is an optional career choice. So when the FBI asked me, let me see your phone book, I told them, I don't have one. I keep my friends' numbers in my head. That was valuable. Yeah. One time he told me, he said, Bobby, let me tell you something, because they caught these guys, you know, app scam and money. He said, Bobby, he says, if you do a crooked deal, if you ever do it, he didn't say don't do one. He didn't say don't do a crooked deal. He said, if you ever do a crooked deal, here in Philadelphia, he said, make sure you do it in November at an Eagles game. At halftime,
yep.
He said, on the 50-yard line, buck naked, he added. Because the Eagles, they don't never leave.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you be the focus of the day. He said, look, and I'm listening. Yeah. And everybody, he said, look, Bobby, I'm police chief. He said, they got stuff that can hear through brick walls. Mm-hmm. He said, in other words, he was telling me story-wise, just don't do it. So things like that affected me. And he was the one that had a big poster on his wall. And I caught my eye. And he said that that's his favorite. It says, it's not the critic that counts. It's not the one who points out how the strong man, how the strong man stumbled or how the doer of good deeds could have done him better. But the credit belongs to the man who's actually in the arena. You know, his face is marred with blood and sweat, who toils, who fails over and over again. But if he fails, and I'm paraphrasing, he fails while daring greatly so that he'll never be numbered with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat. That was a guiding principle in my life.
Yeah, that's powerful.
Awesome. Frank Lazzaro Rizzo. They got a book out about him called The Man Who Would Be King.
That's awesome.
The mayor who became, and that was just one. And then there were others, John Crisconi, Darnell, who told me, you know, listen first. Don't try to impress people with your knowledge base. Wait here. Keep it simple. When you do speak, your words will drop heavy like a ton of bricks, you know, things like that. And all through, there's always been somebody, the congressman, he told me, he says, stay away from the media. He says, in terms of, you know, talking to report, excuse me, he said, if they feel that they made you, they'll feel that it's theirs to break you to.
And
he also told me, whenever you talk to a reporter, this is the congressman. Whenever you talk to a reporter, say as few words as possible. Don't let them take you off point, because they'll go over to hunt and peck and pick through it and take out what they want. He said, don't give them that opportunity. Things like that have always helped me in my public speaking, you know, especially when I'm talking to people like that. And I can go down the list to people who just dropped a nugget, you know, that looked at me and thought I was worth them passing on some information to. And that maybe I would take it. I would pick it up and take it.
Yeah.
But I've met a lot of people. Jimmy Carter actually went back to pick up his briefing book at a presidential debate. He left it at the airport, and I drove all the way out there to get it and brought it back. And it was a leather case that said James Carter. And I gave it to him, but I didn't know his pilot was named James Carter. That was the pilot with the flight plan. So they had to send somebody back. Oh, yeah. Jimmy Carter, George H.W. Bush, I was invited. My wife got a phone from my office, from my leasing company at the time, that the White House called and wanted me to invite me to a reception at the East Room of the White House. All they had to do was catch a Metroliner. She thought it was my brother and them kidding. But it was the invitation, because at that time I was helping some prominent Republicans trying to get to the Black community to let them know that Blacks were historically Republicans. And that not only were there, let me see, I don't want to get this number off, but out of the lynchings in the South from those old slave days till the 1960s, over 3,000 whites were lynched as well, and they were basically all white Republicans. But how many people know that?
Yeah.
You know, because they were registering backs. They were, that's what Condoleezza Rice said. The whites came down, Republicans took her father, got him registered, paid his poll tax and all, and the Democrats didn't like that.
Right.
So they lynched Blacks, but they also lynched white Republicans, over 3,000 of them. And that information is at the Tuskegee Institute University, Tuskegee today, where the Tuskegee Airmen trained back during the war. That's part of their collection and research.
Wow.
That's
crazy.
I'm just telling you, it's just so much.
Yeah.
You know, so much that I've been exposed to.
Before this interview, I think I told Chris that this interview would be like the old saying, a box of chocolates. You never know. You never know what you're going to get.
What's inside it.
Yeah. But it's funny. This has been a good experience for me, because I've known you for a long time and I knew pieces, but the way this kind of flowed together, the life lessons weave through, have been very good. As we kind of start to wrap, one of the things we're always trying to teach and help people, and you've just when you were talking about Frank Rizzo and some of the lessons you've been taught, what are things you would like to impart on our listeners? We have, you know, thousands of downloads every month. What things that maybe, you know, if you think of a person that's trying to master themselves, get better in their life, maybe I look at you and I say, you are a master of many things. And I think communication, interview, your radio persona, everything that you do there, that is masterful, because you've done it for a very, very long time and you've put a lot of effort into it. And then of course, so craft, I think you've been a good example of craft. What do you, anything you want to impart on people?
Well, first of all, somebody said, how could you, I took up fencing because I almost got hit by a car. What's the nexus to that? Well, I was crossing Broad Street, the truck almost hit me, and I was wondering if you could sense danger at that kind of speed, identify where it's coming from, look for an alternative, and then physically get there. Mm-hmm. How quick could you do that? Mm-hmm. And just thinking that, I went into McGonagall Hall because one of my electives I took was springboard diving. Mm-hmm. Hey, if you're going to take an elective, take an elective. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And I was walking and I looked down on the floor where they played the varsity game, and they was having a fencing match. Mm-hmm. And they had it in high school, but I didn't pay any attention. I see this people moving back really, really fast. By the time I'm done, I'm sitting on the bench behind the team. And to make a long story short, watching and what happened, and people planned this, that, and the other, the last minute, you know, somebody changed their plan, could depend, you set them up, you beat it, disengage, you go beat, stand back, and then And I, you know, you set it up. It's like playing chess. Right. You're all the pieces, you know? Right. And I said, wow. So I went and took my last elective. I took a fencing class. And it didn't know it, but then the teacher that taught the class was named Nikki Tomlinson. She was on U.S. Women's Olympic team twice. She called the coach of Temple's team and said, I got two guys in here, me and Martin Aida. She said, I think you need to look at, you know, right there, homegrown. You don't have to be cool.
Right.
And I made the final cut. My first match, varsity match, I won. And they said, do you know what? They was all cheering. And I had beaten the Midwest champion. Well, the only reason why I beat him is because I didn't know what he was doing. You know, the two hardest people to fence is a guy that's really good, and he knows whether what you're doing is a serious threat or not. And the guy that doesn't know nothing.
Just wild.
Yeah, because he don't know if it's a serious threat or not. Anyway, I lost a lot of bouts. And then over the summer, I practiced, went to matches and all, and trained. The following year, I won my first 18 in a row or something. And somebody said, how were you able to do that? My coach said it best. But it was because of my age, having been through the military, having come up through the ghetto, you know, and having to depend more on yourself, like that long walk that day and all these things. You know what he said to me? He said, oh, he's coachable. That's what he said. Most people are not coachable. They don't want to go beyond what it is they know.
Right.
Because the more I know, you know, I had over 19 hours more than I needed to graduate. And if they hadn't stopped me, because I went to get information.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to learn. So I tell people, first of all, be you. Mm-hmm. The you are unique. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody's got two eyes, a nose, and a mouth, but you're unique.
Right.
You're still different. So be you, number one, always try to know. From what you own, listen. In that fact, the Bible says it best. Be quick to hear, but slow to speak and slow to wrath. Listen, don't get angry. Don't say nothing too fast. Just, the other thing is be coachable. If you don't know, let somebody show you.
Right.
You know, find out how it goes on and find out all the things that they are. You have no idea. I'm sick of kids coming up from the ghetto talking about what you want to major with. I want to be a sociologist. Come on, man. Yeah. Well, sociology? And then you wind up working in a parole board in a local county, tracking down prisoners, you know, but they don't know.
Right.
The other thing is have confidence in yourself. You have, like you said, innate ability to develop, to thrive as a human being. You can be born in a little Biafran village and live to be 70, 80, get a chance to go to Ox school or something. And you can be born in a Kennedy family and get sick, have cancer, people die young.
Right.
The Bible says in Ecclesiastes, I think it's chapter 9, and I'm going to paraphrase this because it says, the race is not always won by the swiftest, nor is the battle always won by the strongest, but time and chance happens to us all.
Right.
Time and chance. So what is time and chance? I call, people say, man, you're lucky. No. If luck is when preparation meets opportunity, the result is luck, and I'll call it luck.
Right.
Or I'll say luck is the natural residue, what's left over from hard work.
Right.
It wasn't easy. It's not going to be easy, but it's worth working for.
Right.
And like Betty Turner said, he said, Bob, she said, she's former mayor. She said, you amaze me. You move, you boo, you do. She said, and if somebody stops you, blocks you, you keep going. And if you realize you had a dead end, she said, you get up, you dust yourself off, and you move on somewhere else.
Right.
I would say, again, that people ought not to let other people define them. Hmm. A lady told me in church, she said, this guy Leon, he's the only one to come. You ain't going to be nothing. I don't know why she said that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe because I ran around all the time and I was energetic. And I wasn't bad. I was spirited. You know, they say wild colts make the best horses. But the other thing, I think the most important thing is you need balance in your life. If you just deal with the secular humanist aspects of information and life, you're doomed. And I'm not talking about just doomed and you're not going to be successful and have a business and make some money. I'm talking about finding the things like happiness, contentment, joy. Look, I am, and I told them on the radio, I support the Tea Party, but I'm not a Tea Party conservative. Mm-hmm. I support fiscal conservatism. Right. I don't spend what you don't have.
Right.
My dad taught me that. He also told me, my dad, let me just mention him, Bucky Jones. He said, told me when I was little and didn't want to study and all, hitting my hands, making me to memorize the man. And that's why I got memorizing. I know God gave me good memory, but if I didn't know how to work it, once I got an answer, I never forgot. I never forgot the answer because
right.
he whacked, you know. Yeah. He said, you're going to have to be twice as good. He said, to get half the chance in this world. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the 50.
Right.
He said, but when you get the chance, you will be twice as good.
Yeah.
That's what he said to me. And that's the radio.
Right.
I got the chance
and
I was twice as good.
Right.
And the public recognize it and they only recognize it. But the let me see, I lost my train of thought for a second because I always go off on these tangents. But you'll cut it.
It's what makes the show interesting, right? The Bob Jones Show.
And my dad taught me that, which is an important factor in the life. But you need balance in your life.
Right.
I am not an evangelical Christian conservative, although I am a Christian. And evangelist means just being willing to tell it and say it.
Right.
I am a biblical worldview conservative. That's my pulsar. I believe that is God. I believe God created. The founder said, we hold these truths to be self-evident. For me, it's obvious that God created this.
Right.
And it says self-evident that God created us and is self-evident and endowed us, gifted us certain unalienable rights, rights that ought not to be taken away. Among them, not limited to life, liberty, and the pursuit of opportunity or happiness. And the very next sentence says, in fact, and to secure, to make sure we don't lose these guys, we institute government.
Right.
I don't know how many people even know that, and they don't understand. So you are unique. If you have balance in your life, I say right now, when black people talk about racism and the white man, I say, wait a minute, are you a Christian? The Bible said, it asked a question, if God be for you, who can be against you?
Right.
And then in case you're a numbskull and can't figure it out, if God be for you, I'm here to say he's more than the whole world, even though it does against you. Right. That's what it says. Mm-hmm. And if God decides to bless you or agrees to bless you, your boss can be the grand dragon of the Ku Klux Klan. Mm-hmm. God said to make you go the way I want. He said, I'll put a hook in your nose, the imagery, turn your head and make him bless you every way but loose. I mean, there's no excuse for poor me, for sitting back, for not trying,
right.
for not doing, not if you believe in God,
right.
especially if you say that you're a Christian. So balance in life, be coachable. Let people teach you and tell you. You can probably, and you don't like it, but was he telling you the truth? Mm-hmm. And dare to be different. Dare to be different, dare to be great. Great people were not like all the same people. Yep. They started out like that, but there's something else that they wanted. And if you can't do it, find something else. But the point again is you are unique. You're a unique individual and you have all the potential, just like you have all the potential in your body. If you give it the right food and the right fuel and the right nourishment and the right exercise and all those things, you got to worry about no artificial triggering of your immune system. Your immune system jumped right into action. All of those are what I would suggest.
So one of the things that I heard through all of this, if someone listens to this interview from beginning to end, is lifelong learning. And I'm not even going to ask you the question if you're going to keep doing what you're doing and stuff, because you're so passionate about it. It's obvious you have the energy to continue to learn. There is no end to that. It's just continuing.
I am always in learning mode.
That's right.
And I tell them that radio, talk radio, is as much listening as it is talking.
Right.
I've got to listen. I got to hear the response, how they say it, the way they say it, vocal inflections, I got to look beyond what they're saying to what I perceive they actually mean by that, the reason why, and then listen and then responds in a way that the public who have different perceptions of what they're hearing, and then my response is all but not disrespectful. I don't want to be disrespectful in the least. So, and now people say, boy, you're so patient with that person. Bob, you're a better man than I. No, I'm listening.
You're just listening.
And they don't have anybody else to talk to but me.
Right.
And so I'll do that. We'll have that conversation. But it is about listening. That the Bible said, be quick to hear.
Yeah.
I got that from the Bible.
Right.
Slow to speak and slow to wrath.
So, Chris, it's been a very powerful interview. Kind of Rogan style. We went pretty long on this one because it needed to do that. I think this is one we just had a really
it's
powerful.
It's going to end up on the cutting room floor.
No. We just had an interview here recently with a very, very, another kind of long interview because it was necessary and because of the content and quality of what we were hearing. And this is going to be no different. Before I close out and make sure everyone knows how to hear Bob's show and interact with him, any final thoughts, Chris?
I'm just going to say thanks, Bob. And I'm really, envious of the people there in South Texas to get to listen to you every day because.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you of all the experiences that you've had, you know, you've probably lived three lifetimes worth of, experiences. Yeah. So I think it's cool to hear your stories and, you know, really share part of that every day with your listeners. So just thanks for coming on with us and sharing part of
your life. Thank you. I didn't even give a chance to talk about when I went to Israel, when I went to France, when I went to Martinique in the jungle. I actually lived with people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Israel is the biggest little country I've ever been in.
Mm-hmm.
It seems huge, but at one point it's only 9 miles wide. But that's a story for another day.
Yeah.
How would you like people to reach you? What's the best way to hear? Because I know I listen on the net. So what do you think is the best way for people to hear the Bob Jones Show? Because there's going to be people that hear this that have never been exposed. I would say most people that hear this show have never heard your program. So I know that it has internet access besides the local.
Well, there's
radio.
An app.
Yeah.
There's a Keys app, 1440 Keys. Mm-hmm. It's on iStore or whatever.
It's on iTunes.
It's on Apple, but it's also on Google Play.
Google Play. Okay.
Yeah.
You can go to www.1440keys.com. And it says, listen now.
Right.
If you want to just take the player.
And nowadays you have it set up where you guys can text in or
they can call or text on the app. They can text right from the app.
Oh, they can do it through the app. Okay.
Yeah. Right now,
what we'll do is put a link for the app on our, cause we'll have a write up for the program.
And that'll probably be
the best way. I'll put that in there. And then hopefully, if you're a listener from this show and you have decided to listen to the 1440 Keys show, please let him know a shout out from the WFO Life podcast.
Okay.
We appreciate you being on and sharing your story with us.
Well, thank you. And Chris, for a second, I envied you because of my history back in those snow-covered Pennsylvania, only for a second or two.
Yeah.
It's pretty in that, but I realized I can't feel my toes anymore. So I probably should go and say.
Before you hang up, let me show you something that I took 2 days ago when the temperature was 81 outside you know, you got to get that vitamin C. I mean, you got to get that. You know, I eat fat in my diet, butter, and we cook with lard and things like that. And I take, you know, Cataplex C and but the sunshine. Can you see this?
Yeah. Yeah, I can see it. Oh, man.
That'll be the photo that we use for the show. That'll be his cover photo
for the
show.
What was 2 days ago? Today's the 6th.
Yeah, it was like a couple
of days. February the 4th.
Yeah.
2021 in South Texas.
Sitting in his back.
It could be like the Chamber of Commerce ad, you know, come, you know, escape the Northeast, come to Corpus in February.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, we're going to sign off for the day. Chris, thanks again. I'll be in touch.
Thanks.